Thank you, Ralph. I hope that wasn't too big a buildup. Well, all immigrant groups have gone through the same, though not identical, transition from them to us. A law requiring public schools to teach all major subjects in English only was a major controversy in Wisconsin a little over 100 years ago, and it decided an election for governor and the targeted ethnic group, those uncivilized Germans. Wisconsin started out on a very tolerant note. The convention that wrote the original Constitution in 1848 specified that it was to be printed in three languages, English, German, and Norwegian. The original Constitution also allowed non-citizens to vote in state elections, as long as they had lived in Wisconsin for at least 6 months and proclaimed their intention to become citizens. And, of course, were males over the age of 21. But things went downhill from there. The two ethnic groups which dominated Wisconsin through the last half of the 1800s were the Germans and the Yankees, people whose families had migrated from New England and New York. The Yankees were mostly Protestants of a puritanical background and were leaders of the temperance movement, and they deplored the Germans because many of them were Catholic. Even worse, most of them drank beer on Sundays with their families in public parks. This was intolerable. The first major confrontation came in 1872 with the passage of a law that would have put most taverns out of business by requiring them to put up a bond of $2,000, a huge sum of money in those days. That law was repealed in 1873, but the debate over prohibition of alcohol, of course, continued for decades. The debate over English only came to a head in 1889 with their law that required all major subjects in public schools to be taught in English only. This united the Germans against the dominant Republican Party. The Catholic Germans had mostly voted Democratic, but the Protestant Germans, along with the mostly Protestant Scandinavians, usually voted Republican. But the Lutheran Germans and Scandinavians saw the law as a threat to their language and culture and their parochial schools. Now, backers of the law said they were only defending Americanism and trying to help the poor immigrants. The Milwaukee Sentinel, which was staunchly Republican, attacked the opposition, saying, "This unholy crusade against the common schools is carried on by a coalition of priest, pettifogger, politician, and poltroon." People don't have artistic insults like that anymore. Anyway, on the other side, the German Catholic Excelsior called the law a war against the German language and religion and said they intend to forbid you, brave German, your noblest treasure on earth, your melodious mother tongue. It's the only time I've ever seen German referred to as melodious, but I guess this is a matter of taste. That law was repealed in 1890 after the Republicans were thrown out of office by the combined voting of most Germans and Scandinavians. And in fact, the only time that Democrats won the governor's office between the Civil War and the New Deal were in 1873 as a result of that tavern law and 1890 as a result of the English-only law. Now, World War I, of course, ended most attempts to preserve the German language and culture, but assimilation was underway long before then. The Milwaukee Sentinel, perhaps realizing that nearly half of its potential readers were Germans, extended an olive branch in 1904, saying of the Germans, "They have taught us some much-needed lessons in the art of cheerful and pleasurable living." Stereotypes change over decades, you know. The Sentinel continued, "American life was comparatively a hard, prosaic, and sad-colored business before our settlers from the continent helped us to dispel the shadow of the too austere Puritan standard of living. So far from the U.S. having proven the grave of German characteristics, it has really proven the fruitful seed field of some of the best and most gracious German characteristics." By the way, the assimilation of earlier immigrant groups was not as fast as critics of current groups think. The 1910 census, which was the first that recorded languages, found that there were several areas of Wisconsin in which more than 20% of the population still spoke only German, and most of those were second and third generation Americans. Now, about half of Wisconsin residents today have German ancestry. That's the largest percentage in the country. And I'm curious, how many folks here have German ancestry? Me too, in spite of my name. I think that's about half. Now, how many are 100% German? Oh, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. About half before, now 5. Well, that's assimilation. And if the past is prologue, current and future immigrant groups will follow a similar pattern as they make the transition from them to us. Lila?
My name is Lila Pine, and I am a member of James Reeb congregation here, and my husband Craig McComb and I spend our winters each year in Tucson, Arizona, which is only 60 miles from the Mexico border. What you have heard about immigration so far applies to many immigrants, regardless of color or nationality. But I've been working at the U.S.-Mexico border for the past 5 years, as well as with many Latino immigrants here in Madison and all over the Midwest. I've been confronted daily with the awful reality of what happens to these brown-skinned Latino immigrants from Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Colombia. This is the key difference between immigrants from Latin America and immigrants from Europe. Over the past 5 years, as a volunteer with the humanitarian aid organization No More Deaths, which is the primary social justice ministry of our UU Church of Tucson, I've witnessed the systemic persecution of these hard-working, good-hearted, but poor people. And my attention has been focused on their suffering, the humiliation, the fear, and constant anxiety of raids and physical attacks, of losing their U.S. citizen children, and suffering years of family separations across the border due to U.S. immigration policies, of living in the shadows in a country here that has destroyed the economies of their homelands, left them without any jobs, and for 2 decades has repeatedly denied them the documents to work here legally. Many people of faith, including UUA President Peter Morales and the UUA social justice staff, are also focused on these issues of the persecution and deaths of more than 5,000 men, women, and children at our border through the Homeland Security policy of deterrence. We call it deterrence by death. And the deliberate murders of hundreds of others by vigilantes and white supremacists. We are rising up against the injustice and the human rights violations we have witnessed, not only at the border, but in towns and cities all across America, including here in Madison. Injustices by unscrupulous employers who hire them, then have them deported before they pay them for their work. We have a word for that, it's slavery. By white supremacists who murder the first Latino they see on the street. By vigilantes like those who just this summer broke into an immigrant family's home in Arivaca, Arizona, and murdered the 29-year-old father and his 9-year-old little girl. The mother just barely escaped by hiding under the bed. By heavily armed Border Patrol and ICE agents, ICE stands for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, what used to be the INS, by Border Patrol and ICE agents at workplace raids and midnight break-ins into their homes, violating both U.S. and international human rights laws and terrorizing their families in hundreds of private, for-profit, secret immigration detention facilities that have sprung up all over our nation just in the past 5 years. Historically, many immigrants from many different countries have been treated very unfairly. It's true. But this is something relatively new here. We are arresting and incarcerating people for long periods of time without even bringing charges against them, sometimes up to 5 years of incarceration, just for not having the right papers. We are criminalizing the poor and people of color with our U.S. immigration policies. Our government has been deliberately funneling migrant families through the most treacherous parts of the border by building walls at all the safe entries. And this has led to thousands of unnecessary deaths. And people of faith are rising up against this, demanding justice. That's why immigration was such a big focus at this year's UUA General Assembly in Salt Lake City. That's why so many UU congregations across the country are standing up for human rights for immigrants and demanding that ICE and Border Patrol stop prosecuting humanitarian aid workers, including those from No More Deaths, persecuting immigrants, and demanding, and we are demanding, comprehensive immigration reform to fix our broken and unjust immigration policies. Just this summer, the father of the sanctuary movement of the 1980s, the now retired Reverend John Fife of the Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, at a press conference attended by 50 different humanitarian aid groups and churches, including the UU Church of Tucson, said, quote, "In seeking the cooperation of government officials and the Department of the Interior, the 50 organizations represented here today will affirm their commitment to work to end the humanitarian, environmental, and human rights crises on the border. It is our firm belief that faith, good sense, civic responsibility, and the law require us to do so. The error of border enforcement that uses death as a deliberate deterrent must come to an end. We can no longer ignore the reality of more than 5,000 deaths at the border and the horrendous conditions and human rights abuses at immigration detention facilities all over the country, including here in Wisconsin. We must educate ourselves through faith bodies, civic and community organizations, in the midst of a media blackout that hides the truth and that panders to fear and hate. These issues are complex, and the myths about so-called illegal aliens, that's in quotes, a hideous term that attempts to criminalize and dehumanize people whose only crime has been to try to provide food and shelter and a decent life for their children, must be exposed to daylight. The UU Church of Tucson, where Craig and I spend 5 months each winter, will be submitting a social action issue, or SAI, proposal on comprehensive immigration reform at General Assembly next June, which will be in Minneapolis, and we will be asking for your support. Our Tucson UU Church has also partnered with a nonprofit humanitarian aid group called No More Deaths, one of about 10 at the border, which each year saves hundreds of human lives that could who could otherwise die in the desert near the Arizona-Mexico border. No More Deaths, again, is the primary social justice ministry at the UU Church of Tucson and saves hundreds of human lives at the border. We have also been documenting human rights abuses against immigrants by the Border Patrol and negotiating with the Department of Homeland Security in Washington, D.C. on new regulations and enforcement of humane custody standards in federal and private immigration detention centers at the border. We also published a report last year called Crossing the Line, Human Rights of Migrants in Short-Term Custody on the Arizona-Mexico Border, where we documented human rights abuses against 345 immigrants who we interviewed personally. And we've presented our findings at a congressional hearing. We're in the midst of negotiating, again, with Homeland Security and others in the Obama administration for humane treatment of immigrants in these facilities, as well as comprehensive immigration reform. But the No More Deaths ministry depends heavily on the faith community and individuals like you for funding its humanitarian aid at the border, to pay for repairs and maintenance for its search and rescue vehicles, and to buy food, water bottles, medicine and first aid supplies, diapers and formula, blankets and clothing for migrants who might not otherwise survive the five-day-long, 75-mile trip on foot through the most treacherous parts of the desert at the border. We will be collecting donations later after your regular offertory, and for those of you who may have brought your checkbooks, we'd be very grateful for checks and or cash, whatever you can give for this humanitarian aid cause. The checks should go to the UUCT and write the words No More Deaths on the memo lines. Cash donations will also be gratefully accepted until we stop the government policy of deterrence by death. There are also yellow handouts outside in the lobby, and for those who wish to learn more about this issue, the handouts include resources like videos and websites and books. Near the immigrant trails out near Arivaca, there is an altar with a poem written for the families of the thousands of people who have died trying to find work, food, and a way to provide for their starving families back home. For the right to live in peace, and to those who have died in the desert. In memory of those who went to look for a better life, yet only encountered death. In memory of those who risked everything and lost everything. Of those who went with hope in their eyes and challenge in their souls. The sun burned them and the desert devoured them, and the dust erased their names and faces. In memory of those who never returned, we offer these flowers and say with the deepest respect, your thirst is our thirst. Your hunger is our hunger. Your pain is our pain. Your anguish, bitterness, and agony are also ours. We are a cry for justice that no one would ever have to leave their land, their beliefs, their dead, their children, their parents, their family, their roots, their culture, their very identity. From out of the silence comes a voice that speaks so that no one will ever have to look for their dream in other lands, so that no one would ever have to go to the desert and be consumed by loneliness. A voice in the desert cries out, education for all, opportunity for all, jobs for all, bread for all, freedom for all, justice for all. We are a voice that will not be lost on the desert, that insists that the nation give equal opportunity to a dignified and fruitful life to all its children.
You're Thanks, Amber. I am an immigrant. You can't tell it by looking at me, but as soon as I say a few words, it becomes very apparent I am from elsewhere. The first question I'm often asked is, where are you from? After over 40 years, that question is getting a bit old. And if the circumstances are right, I answer Atlantis. You see, in England, I am thought by those who don't know me to be from elsewhere too. Then a guessing game begins, and often any English-speaking country is up for grabs. When the First Unitarian Society Lay Worship Committee decided to offer this reflection in response to the UUA's Standing on the Side of Love campaign on the weekend of General Assembly, I was the obvious candidate to pull it together, but had no idea where to start. The subject is extraordinarily complex, convoluted, and emotionally charged. Everyone who comes to this country has a different story, and the data and opinions abound. Then this spring, I spent 10 days in Vernon County on my 40 acres of land pulling garlic mustard. Garlic mustard was brought over by German immigrants. In Europe, it's used as a pot herb. Here was a different sort of immigrant under my very own nose. Many of you undoubtedly have experience of moving from one place to another, but immigration exacerbates the feeling of vulnerability. To enter this country, I had to answer invasive personal questions, have a military-style physical by US governmental authorities, and submit to blood tests and required immunizations. I was fortunate I spoke the language and did not have to make major transitions over that, mere adjustments, mostly in pronunciation and phraseology. After I got here, for instance, I was corrected by an 18-year-old from Cambridge, Wisconsin, who had never been further from home than Madison, when I said tomato, which I still say. And schedule, which I changed, and nappy, which I was working in a pediatrician's office, and they were foreign words to her. There are also some embarrassing no-nos here, which I won't go into, about which I was fortunately forewarned. To my chagrin, my exemplary but foreign professional credentials were discounted. Midwives were understood only at that time as little old ladies with dirty fingernails. That was in the 60s. There were also other surprises. Ordinary things like flour, sugar, and rice are milled differently in other countries. And they work differently in familiar recipes. Shopping was a challenge for a while, but at least I could read the packages, unlike some. So you'll understand why it's very common to send for familiar foodstuffs and seeds from home, and then you can eat something normal. So back to the garlic mustard. This is a very useful plant that has no enemies here. It's hardy, one of the first plants to show up in the spring, and great for an early salad when everything else is scarce and you've lived on dried beans and eked out wizened root vegetables through a longer winter than is usual in Europe. However, now it's taking over the native woods here and is considered to be an invasive species. Its Achilles heel is that it's a biennial, and so if you can find it, catch it in time, and pull it, it can be controlled, if not eradicated, within a few years. The metaphor was not lost on me. I sat pulling these plants for hours, thinking about this immigrant species taking over the world. It provided the best meditation I could ever have wished for. I recommend it. But people are not plants. they can move, adjust, and acclimatize quickly to changing circumstances, which is, after all, why our species is now messing up this planet from the top of the food chain. Moving from place to place to improve circumstances is a long-standing human activity that is not really about individuals. Suspicion of each other is triggered by a much more basic animal instinct. The stranger or other upsets accustomed stability and comfort and forces change. In mythology, the stranger functions as a messenger who embodies and mirrors the extraordinary and brings light to the shadow. Every country has a shadow, and America is now being forced, with the rest of the world looking on, to face the violence and racism that is part of its history and has for too long been swept under the rug. Over the few centuries this country has existed, poor or non-speaking English groups who have come here in number have consistently been scapegoated. But it also happens in every other country of the world. It's the them and us division. Now it just happens to be the turn of our southern neighbors, most of whom are filling the jobs most American workers will not consider. Almost every immigrant argument used today has been heard before, as John's story illustrates. 250 years ago, Benjamin Franklin complained about bilingual signposts and swarms of unassimilable Germans migrating into Pennsylvania. Later, people like Samuel Morse, inventor of the telegraph, became the founder and generous contributor to the anti-immigrant and anti-Catholic Know-Nothing movement. And he railed against the Irish immigrants who were subverting the values of Anglo-America. He advised keeping them out of the country. By the latter part of the 19th century, yellow peril was the war cry, caused by increased migration from Asia. A contemporary cartoon depicts Lady Liberty as a Chinese coolie holding an opium pipe, with the emanating rays of light labeled immorality, filth, disease, ruin to white labor. And Henry George, the political economist, denounced what he called the Mongolianization of America. Today, the same long list of similar myths and fears has been exacerbated by the Twin Tower attack of 9/11 and has been spiced with religion and is aimed at those of Muslim origin and border crossers. The fear is further intensified by fearmongers and the media and governmental oratory. It's better now than it was. The war on terror has resulted in a punitive and limiting immigration policy that restricts visas for those who in the past have benefited this land. I often wonder if Einstein or Fermi would get a visa today. It has also increased paranoia. Those who feed these fears venerate an ancient monster. Is it a real entity or just a figment of fertile imaginations and paranoid rhetoric? The only difference now is the largest group of people is crossing a political border instead of coming by boat. This imaginary line, which, like the equator and Greenwich, was created for convenience, was drawn relatively recently in world history by political conquest. In fact, this political stranger is completely fictional. History, statistics, and rational thought reveal it to be so. Recent reports paint an entirely different picture. Most immigrants pay taxes and social security. They all pay sales tax and property taxes, and certainly put more into the governmental coffers than they take out. And because lower skilled workers from abroad usually fill less desirable jobs, American workers tend to be more upwardly mobile. although it is indeed true many send home money to families abroad, this makes it possible for these others to have a better standard of living in their countries of origin rather than joining the migration trail. The workers also spend money here. After all, they have to take care of themselves too. Do you have any idea how difficult a language English is to learn, especially if your own language uses a different alphabet and grammar? Most non-English speakers struggle mightily to make themselves understood. They have to, for practical reasons. Most also eventually apply for citizenship, even in the face of difficult requirements and huge backlogs that can delay the process for years. I became a citizen when frustrated during the Reagan administration. I wanted a vote. Until then, like most immigrants, my husband David and I experienced taxation without representation. We're much less likely to commit crimes than our native-born counterparts, for we risk deportation if arrested. And two-thirds of us are in fact here lawfully. David, like many, came to study under an expert in his field and originally entered on a student visa. Contrary to rumor, half of all undocumented immigrants initially enter the United States legally on some sort of visa. Most of the 9/11 hijackers were here legitimately. The popular belief that increased border security and border fences curb the flow of immigrants is totally untrue. Instead, they've only succeeded in pushing border crossers into more dangerous and less patrolled regions, as Lila's presentation indicates, and have actually served to increase the undocumented population by creating an incentive to quietly stay put and out of trouble on this side of the border. Finally, security experts agree that the best deterrent to terrorism is excellent intelligence. So to target immigrants is self-defeating. For a new immigrant to reach out to authorities, even if you are in trouble or being exploited, can be risky. After all, you never know what might happen. Some agency might round you up and deport you. Better to lay low and keep quiet. I am not the same woman who crossed the Atlantic 43 years ago. I'm no longer a stranger in this land, but through circumstances I could not have foreseen when I came, have made it my home. My children were born here, as were many of your ancestors, and my grandchildren will be born here. Their contributions can be seen clearly all around, including the pot herbs. Every group who comes brings with them something of their own culture, their own new ideas, and long experiential history from their country of origin. Experience this country does not have. Most cultures have stories in which a stranger brings treasure to the community. Some examples are Ovid, introduced Baucis and Philemon, Shakespeare, Shylock and Othello, among others. Jesus exhorts us to welcome the Samaritan and the disenfranchised. Native American stories have a white deer or buffalo maiden, depending on the tribe, carrying a peace pipe. And African legends bring people gods of varying characteristics into being. There are also Asian stories too. The stranger represents the door to a fearless life that crosses thresholds and boundaries, a step nearer to integration and wholeness. History is destined to repeat itself unless the past is brought into consciousness and integrated. This is the gift of the stranger. Valuable human resources are entering this land and in the process creating a magnificent mosaic. It takes a risk to open oneself to such influences, and it might mean feeling insecure for a time. But I encourage you to reach out to the strangers who cross your path, and then, like me, you might find yourself in another place, and maybe it too will be called Atlantis. And now I'd like to take just a moment to imagine the person next to you is a stranger, speaks another language, and is from a different cultural tradition. Some of you, that is indeed the case. In the following short silence, discover your own unique way of reaching out to such a person. It might be as simple as a smile or something more active. And the next time you do it, you meet a stranger, do that too.
Thank you, Roz. We have just about 4 minutes for a comment. And Mary, do you want to hand that microphone?
Well, many of you know Nancy Graham. Every year spends a longer time in Tucson and goes to the same church that Lila does. And your social action chairman and her husband Andrew, members of this social action committee, will be joining them in a couple of weeks for 3 months. So while Dave Johnson will be carrying on for me here, I hope we'll be able to carry Prairie's spirit on this issue down in Tucson.
I'm sensitive. Our daughter is marrying a wonderful undocumented lad from Mexico, but I don't think I feel I'm being offered a false choice, and that the concept of social justice has boundaries far beyond what we're talking about. Because I don't think it's true that the people who immigrate are taking jobs Americans don't want. I think that I remember when I was growing up, I had a neighbor across the hall in the apartment who was a taxi cab driver, lived a middle class life as a taxi cab driver. And you don't see a single native-born taxi cab driver in America anymore. None of us make our living washing dishes, picking weeds, or any of those other jobs. We're all into the intellectual class. We don't suffer the outcome of what when you take on the mantle of nobility and say, I'm not going to be prejudiced against the other, there are outcomes from that nobility that affect other people and not us. And the reason why we were so upset about the lower middle class in America voting for Reagan is our inability to see that nobility requires more than being noble about things that don't adversely impact us. And that we have to, in order to be noble about not being prejudiced against the other, also care about, and what are we going to do about, the people who work with their hands in America as the manufacturing industry closes? And what are we going to do about that? And unless we expand social justice to include that as what we're considering, it's a false nobility.
Okay. The time for discussion is now over. We can invite everyone to discuss and speak with our speakers. I can tell you this topic is not a simple, it is not an easy, it does get people not only conceptually involved, but it is a deeply emotional and deeply troubling topic. So that I'm not going to, no, because we have only 7 minutes left, and we've got to finish the announcements and do the offertory, and we have a congregational meeting that we have to start preparing for. So that if you want to have a discussion on this, you can't do it in 3 minutes. because that is cheating the complexity of the problem. So I think that's why I'm gonna close it off here, because this atmosphere does not lend itself to the fullness and the deserving kinds of comments and questions and concerns that it needs to be addressed. And I would like to say that our congregation should schedule meetings where we can do this in a much more embracing and worthwhile discussion. So I'm gonna take that kind of liberty. Let us now prepare to receive the morning offering. We're taking two offerings. The first is the prairie offering, and then the second offering is for the program that Lila discussed on the No More Deaths program, and she mentioned how you may make out a check, or cash is also appreciated. Thank you.
How do you say to your child in the night, nothing's all black, but that nothing's all white? How do you say it will all be all right when you know that it might not be true? What do you children may not obey.